Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Welcome to the penultimate program in my life and times story. I'm Rob Greaves, and it's been my pleasure to host Listen to Older Voices for an 18-year period. And now, as the program comes to an end, I thought I'd share some of my story. There's a little of my dark years in this program as I talk about how my friend David introduced me to a friend of his, Charles, who, on learning I'd been an industrial chemist, took an interest in me for the possibility of some quite illegal activities. I share the story of being a taxi driver and then on buying a van, how I became a taxi truck driver, and how all of this led to going up north to the small Queensland town of Corroy, where I lived in a house in the middle of a state forest with no power or running water. My story then moves to how my friends and myself were set up by a notorious local detective, who some would claim was corrupt, and how we fronted a kangaroo court and ended up being run out of the state. But it doesn't end there. When I was visited in Melbourne by some detectives, you see, someone set a bomb in a cupboard for that detective to find, but sadly, it ended up killing a child. Music plays a large part of my life, and in this part of my story, I share many stories of the Electric Glue recording studio David and I set up in Sydney, of our first LP release, and of meeting and joining forces with the late and great Australian musician, Jeff Crozier. We pick up with me discussing how I earned an income at this stage of my life. And finding a real bond, we ended up moving together into a shared house in Portland Place in South Yarra, where we lived for a good 12 months with a house full of like-minded people. And again, life was wonderful. Most of my income was gained from driving taxis, although at that stage, David had purchased a van, a Morris LD5 van, which was a wonderful old thing. Not very popular anymore for people that were driving vans for a job. So there were very few new parts, but plenty of spare parts. And it wasn't very much later that I bought my own Morris LD5 and took up doing parcel delivery. Eventually, Portland Place ran its course, and David and I moved into a temporary house elsewhere. I don't even remember where it was. I think it might have been Camberwell. And we went back to driving taxis. I also bought myself my very first dog. 1973, we were driving along in David's LD5, and there was this traction engine display on the side of a road, and David stopped to have a look at it, and there was a guy there selling pups, and I put my hand into the pen and one came up and bit me straight away, and I thought, okay, that dog wants me. And it was a girl, and so I called it Acid because the bite was so painful. And then I thought, oh, that's not a good enough name for a lovely little puppy like you. So she became known as Astrid, also known as Astrid the Wonder Dog, and she travelled basically all around Australia, which I'll get to shortly. Having an LD5 each, David and I then drove up to Queensland in our respective LD5s with Astrid as my companion, and we rented a small farmhouse in the middle of a state forest, which was around about, 14, 15 kilometres to the township of Corroy. We had no power, water was via a tank, no heating. There must have been electricity because there were lights. But of course, it was a really basic living, very basic living. But we didn't care. We had a wonderful time there. We went off, I recall, it came to a very ignominious end when we went out one day and came home and David said, got a feeling somebody's been here. And I said to him, oh, don't be silly. Like, we're in the middle of nowhere. This is in the middle of a state forest. Nobody's going to come visiting and wander through our house. Anyway, around about, 5 o'clock the next morning, the doors burst open and we were raided by local police, headed by a guy called Detective Sergeant Dorries. They took us to the police station, where Dorries made it very clear that we were going to go into a closed court and we better plead guilty or there'd be consequences. Now, at that stage, David and I were sharing the house with a couple of ladies, one of whom had a young child, and it was made clear to us that if we didn't plead guilty to possession, the child would be taken away from the mother by the state. I said, hang on, we're due for a phone call. So Dorrie's dialed a number and I said, oh, hello, is that a solicitor? And he said, yes. And I said, oh, look, we've been unfairly charged and I need some advice. And the voice on the other end of the phone said, oh, look, you've done nothing wrong. You've got nothing to worry about. Goodbye, and hung up. So that was the extent of our legal representation. It was like something in some sort of weird novel. We were put in a cell each. It literally had water running down the walls and moss on the floor. And they did play the classic good cop, bad cop. I had the good cop who was, you know, shaking his head and saying, oh, it shouldn't be like this. In the meantime, Dorries is in the room next door to David, berating him and threatening him. So we go into a closed court. The magistrate says, I don't want you to say anything. I find you guilty. $1,600 fine each, which back in 1973 or so, 74, was a lot of money. And we were told we would be escorted to the state border and never to come back. So our stay in Queensland came to an abrupt end. And we left many good friends behind, including some fellow musicians. And as a follow-up to that, about, I don't know, 4 or 6 weeks later, I was back living with my parents at that stage. And it was a Sunday morning. I remember clearly there was a knock on the front door and I answered it. And there were two very well-dressed men there and they introduced themselves as Victorian detectives. And they asked me to step outside, which I appreciated later on that they didn't ask to come in. And they informed me, they asked me, had I been in Queensland recently? And I said, yes. Had I been in Corroy? And I said, yes. And they said, do you know Detective Sergeant Dorries? And I said, well, I know that he set me up and basically ran me out of the state. Why? And they said, well, apparently there was a phone call made to Dorries's desk, and he was told that there was a large supply of drugs in a cupboard in this abandoned house. And so he and his squad headed off there. And apparently just before they got there, a young kid wandered in and happened to open the cupboard by total coincidence and triggered off a bomb. And the child was killed. And it was meant for Dorries. That's how many people he had upset. Somebody really taking him to task. So when I explained that I'd been back in Melbourne 6 weeks, it was quite obvious I had nothing to do with it. They just thanked me and went their own way. But it did reflect on the fact that the reputation that Dorries had for setting people up and just being a downright nasty Queensland policeman certainly had rung true. A follow-up to that story is that a couple of years later, I believe he moved to the Northern Territory where he was promoted to a superintendent. So, well, what else can I say?
Listen to older voices, where stories from the past find a home in the present.
I'm Ron Greaves and I'm sharing some of my story with you, and currently I'm thinking back to what life was like in the 1970s. Having got back from Queensland and overcome those issues with Dorries, I was lucky enough to get a job as the film unit manager at Crawford Film Productions for Homicide. And I had a most wonderful time there. At that stage, Homicide featured Charles Bud Tingwall, Gary Day, Don Barker, and eventually Dennis Grover joined. And look, it was probably one of the most enjoyable 12 months I've ever had in my life. Sadly, as was to be the case with many jobs I had, many wonderful jobs I had, an incoming Liberal government withdrew its financial support for the film industry and there were layoffs, and so that job ended. So with the Crawfords job coming to an end, David and I were both at loose ends. We read in the newspaper that there was going to be a festival in a place called Manjimup in WA. So we decided, hey, let's go to a festival in Manjimup, WA. David still had his LD5. Mine had disintegrated by now, so I bought a cheap sedan. And so we decided to head across the Nullarbor Plain and find ourselves a festival. Needless to say, the trip across the Nullarbor, even though we knew it was a long, dirty trip, was longer and dirtier than we could ever have imagined. We did stop several times along the coastline, and it was really beautiful, and we met up with a guy who was riding a bicycle across the Nullarbor to Perth, and we had some adventures. Eventually, we hit the Tard section in WA, and there was a motel there, and we decided we did deserve to clean up. We'd been living pretty rough up until that stage, and David opened up the back of the LD5, and this roll of dust just came out and enveloped us. We found our way to Manjimup, only to discover that if there was going to be a festival, we'd have to organise it. And that's not quite what we were expecting. We found a young couple there that were looking after some horses, and this guy who had an issue with sugar. And if he drank two cans of Coke, his blood sugar would go crazy. He would go crazy and he'd spend the whole night drumming away. David slept in his van. I found an abandoned hut made out of bamboo, and we slept there for a couple of nights before we thought, no, this is not for us, and it's time to move on. Now, we were absolutely stone motherless broke. We would stop at orchards and grab a couple of apples to eat to keep us on our way, and eventually we found a way to Perth, and I was able to beg, borrow, or steal some money from my parents, and we found a shared house to live in, and I was able to get some unemployment benefits due to the fact that I had worked at Crawford's and was made redundant. And we eventually found ourselves in Fremantle, which I absolutely adored. I love Fremantle. We hung out in a couple of shared houses. The final one was down the beach at the end of Fremantle, and had a wonderful time. Tried to make a bit of money by putting on some music shows called It's a Mother and It's Another Mother at the Fremantle Town Hall. Neither of them made any money, of course. And at one stage, we were left with dozens and dozens and dozens of cakes and cans of Coke when not enough people turned up. The police did turn up one day, simply because I guess we were looking pretty disreputable. They went through David's van with a fine-tooth comb, couldn't find anything to charge us with. In the end, they said, well, look, if you guys smoke, you obviously keep a clean house. And ended up paying for the Cokes and the cakes, which we had stacked on the front veranda, and we made more money out of the police selling that food and that drink than we ever did promoting music. Sadly, whilst we had a really wonderful time there, I got a message that my father had had a heart attack, and I flew back to Melbourne while David took Astrid back in his van across the Nullarbor, had his own adventures where he stopped at one stage and discovered that his battery had actually dropped out of the van. He had no way of starting it. He and Astrid started walking back, and fortunately for them, it was only a couple of kilometres when he found the battery. In the meantime, in the middle of the desert of the Nullarbor Plains, Astrid managed to find a muddy patch and came back absolutely soaked with mud, much to David's dismay. Anyway, they made it back to Melbourne, and whilst there was a lot more I could have shared to you about our adventures in WA, probably better to move on at this stage. So back in Melbourne, I eventually found a shared house in Brunswick with some social workers. And as a result of that, one of them got me an interview at Winlayton Youth Training Centre for Girls. And before I knew it, I was working as a youth officer in the high security section, where they put away some of the what they call the most difficult girls. And I have to say, there were some times there when it was really tough. Like, I remember they put in some smash-proof windows in the office. I made the big mistake telling the girls that these windows were shatterproof, and the workmen hadn't been gone 3 or 4 minutes when a typewriter came crashing through the window. Yeah, roll. But look, generally the girls, I got on really well with them, and look, they came from broken backgrounds and difficult lives, and really their acting out was in frustration, and I really enjoyed my time with them, despite the fact that they often set the place on fire. It was a bit of an eye-opener, not so much into how troubled the kids were, but how troubled the society was that created the situation for them to be there. While I was there, I was sent to a training course, and it was on that course that I met my wife-to-be, June. And in fact, we married while that course was on, and that was 1977. By 1980, we'd had our first son, Tat or Tarrant, and by 1984, we'd had our second son, Court. And here we are, 45 years later, still happily married. But back to 1977, the course had finished, and June was working at a hostel for girls, where we basically sent our girls when they were ready for transitioning back into the community. And she was offered a job by the woman who was running the youth worker course at the then Community Welfare Training Institute in Bundoora, in Watsonia. And she knocked it back but recommended me, and I met with a woman and I got the job as the course coordinator. And I worked at that for a couple of years. I undertook a welfare officer's course and passed that. And in fact, ended up also training on the welfare officer's courses, which June, my then wife, attended. So we had a very strong connection with the training institute and with a welfare background. It was also a period where I got back into music in a really big, big way, but not playing guitar, but following a passion that I'd started to develop for electronic music. And in fact, it was in 1976 that I built my first synthesizer. And by 1977, I had spent what was then quite a lot of money on buying a whole kit out of synthesizers made by Roland. And David and I formed our first electronic music band, Rainbow Generator, with David initially playing guitar and effects pedals and myself on synths and rhythm machines. David had a yearning to get back to Sydney, so he took off to Sydney while I was working at the Community Welfare Training Institute, and he found a three-story squat in Woolloomooloo, and it wasn't illegal to squat then. In fact, it was easy for him to get power put on. He had three-phase power put on. He cleaned the place up. I went and visited him, helped set it up, and so the Electric Loo Recording Studios was formed at 155 Bourke Street, Woolloomooloo. I was a regular visitor, and my darling wife, bless her socks to today, didn't bat an eyelid. She just let me go up there, and I'd go up there for 2 weeks at a time where we would record, we would play, we would hone our skills, and again, have a wonderful time while producing some fantastic music. We brought out our first album, Dance of the Spheres, on vinyl in 1978, and a track on that, Polyploid Specs, actually won an international music competition for the most innovative electronic track of the year. So we knew we were onto something. Was that there were no rules. There was no such thing as a mistake. We didn't break music rules as much as just ignored them, and that sort of freedom of experimentation really showed through. We played many festivals, including a couple of down-to-earth festivals, Festival of Sydney, and a number of smaller gigs. By 1979, we were ready to expand ourselves. We had played with a number of other people, including Peter Caroline, or Peter Thin as he was also known, who went on to join Gone Wonderland as a keyboard player. But at heart, Rainbow Generator was just David and I. And then we met this most amazing guy, Jeff Crozier. Now, Jeff Crozier was an amazing magician. He was more than a magician. He was a real showman. He was a shaman. And he was known in and around Melbourne during the 70s for putting on some of the most amazing shows before he left for the United States and Paris to hone his skills and, in his mind, to get the fame he desired. Well, he played a lot of great places in Paris and in and around New York and influenced a lot of other people, but eventually came back to Australia quite broke because every dollar Jeff got, he put into the shows. And we met up with him by chance and absolutely connected and formed a group called Corrosion the Generator, and for about 6 months in late 1979 played all around Melbourne in venues such as the Universal Workshop in Fitzroy, the Sandown Hotel. We played for the Magicians Convention in 1979 at the Southern Cross. We played for MLC, we played Billboard, we played San Remo. We were getting a good reputation and becoming very popular. And we decided late 1979 that we should move lock, stock and barrel to David's studio back in Woolloomooloo and rehearse for a national tour. So in January of 1980, we got together for a month in the studio and rehearsed a whole set of music, and Jeff refined his act.
Reincarnation is only for some of us. It's up to you.
I was working, so we decided we'd have to go our own way for a few months while we wrapped up our affairs and prepared for a tour.
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time. Turning back time.
It was during that period that I got a call one fateful night and was told by David that Jeff was dead. He'd accidentally hung himself, trying out a trick, and it was shattering. The news was shattering. David and I had become very, very close since that meeting we had in the late 60s, and whilst we had met and worked with and played with many people, Jeff was the only other person that we truly found an absolute kinship with. He was like a third brother, and the news of his death just absolutely slaughtered us. David did have several tapes of the rehearsals that we were doing, and he and ace percussionist Keith Casey, who had at one stage played with Ayers Rock, put some percussion dubs to some of the tracks. David mixed them down and produced a double vinyl album called Transformer by Crozier and the Generator in remembrance of Jeff. A fantastic album that some, oh, let me just think, that some 34 years later was released in the UK internationally on the Finders Keepers label. And we always said that the music that we produce was 30 or 40 years ahead of its time. And in some ways that proved to be true, as we struggled to sell an initial 333 copies of the album that David produced. But the re-release sold out in about 9 months. So there you go. David and I continued to play music, and he came back down to Melbourne and set up studios around Melbourne over a number of years. And we kept playing together and recording together and bought out some CDs. And eventually David took a career change and became an exercise physiologist and went overseas and met his wife-to-be and now lives in Slovenia. So after some 44 years of friendship, over 30 years of playing together, it came to an end. I didn't stop playing, and I still have a micro studio today and continue to compose and play. However, during this time, David had also moved roughly 1983 or so to a place called Thora, which is just outside of Bellingen in New South Wales. And June and I packed up our house in Flemington and went up to live with David for a while before establishing our own property in Klang. During that time, David and I helped establish Radio 2 BBB in Bellingen and honed our skills, with David becoming in charge of the technical side of things, and I looked after all the external communications for the station and coordinated all the external affairs. We threw ourselves into anything if it meant improving skills and gaining knowledge, and again, a most wonderful time. I took up a job also as a youth worker in Coffs Harbour. That came to an ignominious end when the treasurer stole all the funds and the place was closed down. I got the blame, totally innocent, of course, which was proven subsequently. But, of course, in small towns, rumours get round, I couldn't get a job. So June and I came back to Melbourne and I found work with the Trade Union Training Authority, or TUTA, which committed to training trade unionists in order to assist them in their workplace. I worked very hard at it and was promoted to a national industry training officer with responsibility for the public service, the gas and electricity industries. I obviously did very well at that. Tutor was eventually closed by an incoming Conservative government, and several of us were taken into the ACTU to continue our work as national trainers, and I worked myself up into the position of being the national training manager at the ACTU. At that stage, the idea was to devolve training back into the unions, and the job was done so well that my work was finished. I was given a great redundancy package and took up a job as a research officer with the Furnishing Industry Training Board, where I worked for about 5 or 6 years, had a wonderful time, was quite successful, until that too was closed down by an incoming Liberal state government, at which stage I took up a job as a course coordinator at the Emerald Community House before moving across to being the course coordinator of training at the Upper Yarra Community House. It was during that time that I got the gig in 2004 of also doing the production of the Listen to Older Voices program, and hence a job which I took on for maybe 3 or 4 years as part of a retirement job ended up being 18 years. In the final part of my story next week, in the very final episode of Listen to Older Voices, I try and tie it all up and bring my story right up to date with tales of completing a Master of Education, of German shorthair pointers, environmental concerns, and gardening. Next week, the final story on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.